U.S. I come from Atlanta, Georgia, and we are at about 3.5% unemployment in Atlanta. It is fierce competition for talent. My son was a barista at Starbucks, and after 18 months, he was actually recruited to the CNN building to run their coffee shop. He's a college student, so this is not a career for him. But while in college, he has been learning about human resources and economic development, and he became very, very interested in the news industry. He wanted to work at CNN, and he figured that this is a great place to start. But he had many job offers around town, and he chose to go work at the CNN building and actually run their coffee department. Sounds like small potatoes, but it's actually a pretty big deal. The raise he got was pretty exceptional. So the competition for talent, even for baristas, is pretty exceptional. We have some excellent speakers, and our moderator today for the workforce development session, Lori Lowe, is a partner at Friesberg International, a global management consultancy specializing in executive search, leadership advisory, and management audits. They have offices in London, Birmingham, and Edinburgh. Lori has studied languages at university and began her career with Wolters Kluwer as a legal editor. She joined the UK search firm formed by Deloitte UK following auditor independence, and which rebranded as Friesberg 10 years ago. Now managing partner, they have numerous offices globally. Their clients range from large multinationals and listed organizations through to regional and privately held SMEs and startups across a variety of sectors, including energy, manufacturing, aerospace, outsourcing, pharmaceutical, biotech, retail, and professional services. Lori also sits on the Global Executive Committee for Friesberg, where she is responsible for all communications and lead on strategic growth. She writes extensively on leadership and diversity for a variety of publications. Let's give a warm welcome to Lori and all the panelists for session 5.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and welcome to day 2. I'm delighted to be here and sit with this fantastic panel. We're going to have a very lively discussion, and I think it's fair to say that we're going to have a vast amount to talk about. I have so many questions here, we're not going to get through all of them. In fact, I actually think I'm probably going to ask one question and they're just going to start talking. So my role is going to be to just keep them on track. I will try to leave some room at the end for questions, so if you have any, it would be great if you pop them down, and then, you know, we'll get as many as we can. Could I ask you, first of all, to briefly introduce yourselves to everybody? So if we start with Emma.
Yeah, thanks, Laurie. Delighted to be here today to see you all. My name's Emma Walker, and I'm the Regional Director for Oticon Scotland. Now, Oticon is a global IT consultancy and social enterprise that exclusively employs autistic consultants. The company was launched in Berlin in 2011, and over the last 10 years, we've grown substantially. We now have 18 offices worldwide. We're in Germany, France, Italy, Switzerland, Canada, America, Australia, and of course, the UK, where I'm based. Hopefully, I've not missed anybody out. So globally, we've got more than 300 employees, of which 80% are autistic. Now, I mentioned we're a social enterprise. The social issue that we're trying to address is the fact that only 16% of autistic adults are currently in full-time employment, although 77% say they would like to work. So our social mission at Oticon is to increase the employment prospects of autistic adults with IT skills. We do this by giving them permanent contracts of employment and placing them into client teams that match their skills. We believe that team then sees the skills and abilities, and in particular, the different way of thinking that these individuals bring, and this changes their perception about autism. And very frequently, this then acts as a catalyst for the wider organization to bring in more neurodivergent talent to that organization. Now, not all the clients we speak to like to go down the contractor route, but many are beginning to understand the benefits of having a neurodiverse workforce. So they're keen to understand how they can attract, recruit, and retain their own neurodivergent talent. So at Oticon, we've got over 10 years' experience of doing this. So we're in a unique position to offer training to organizations to give them the confidence to create their own neuro-inclusive workforce. So I'm looking forward to our discussion today and sharing my experience of the benefits of having a neurodiverse workforce. Thank you.
Thank you.
Corinne? Good morning. My name is Karine Clark. I come to you from Salt Lake City, Utah. I want to thank Conway for hosting this event. I made the big trek because I believe in what Conway does and wanted to be very supportive of their first real live event. I work in venture capital. I'm a three-time CEO of tech companies. I serve on public and private boards. I also am the chair of our governor's Office of Economic Development, and I work with universities to make sure that the curriculum really supports what we need in the workforce.
Hello, everyone. I feel like I should change my name to Charlie because I'm surrounded by four angels here on the panel. I'm John Gustavo. I'm glad y'all laughed because I was wondering if there were some people that were older and, you know, as old as I was and got that. But my name is John Gustavo, and I lead HR Economic Development Opportunities for Lockheed Martin Corporation. We're based in Bethesda, Maryland. We're a global security, aerospace, and information technology company. It's principally engaged in the research, design, development, integration, manufacture, and sustainment of advanced technology systems, products, and services. We have over 114,000 employees and operate in over 40 countries. The 106,000 of those employees are US-based, so a lot of the examples I will use are US-based, but should be applicable to the 50 countries represented. And, you know, of the 106 or in the international footprint, the UK is the largest footprint outside of the US. We have the majority of our workforce is scientists and engineers, in addition to other talent segments, including manufacturing, production operations, contracts administration, HR, and other support roles and sustainment roles. We operate four primary business areas, aeronautics, space, rotary missions and systems, where our Sikorsky operation is housed, and missiles and fire control. And we have a fifth business area, enterprise operation, which is the function where I work. My team is the Strategic Workforce Initiatives team. We support our business areas, business area customers and value streams, and our service capabilities to include developing workforce development strategies, designing and implementing quality workforce development programs, including but not limited to work-based learning, such as internships, co-ops, pre-apprenticeships, apprenticeships. We establish public-private partnerships and with government, labor, industry, community partners, workforce and education partners. And we pursue public incentives to partially offset our investment in recruiting, hiring, training, and developing our employees. We also partner internally with our government affairs and communications team to promote our workforce development programs, provide workforce development thought leadership, and help to shape and influence workforce development policy and funding opportunities. So I will hand it over to
you. All right, thank you. Good morning. My name is Patsy. I lead IBM's Global Center of Competence for Location Advisory Services, which is called PLI, or Plant Location International. I started with this practice actually 25 years ago, so I'm definitely not a millennial, when the practice was still part of PwC and then was acquired by IBM when they acquired the consulting arm. And ever since then, really every day, every single day of my career, I have been helping clients in making the right choices around where to locate, where to expand, where to consolidate their operations, and also have been helping economic development organizations in trying to attract those investors to their regions. And of course, at the core of a lot of our work is the whole talent equation. What is the quality, the availability, and the cost of talent in each and every one of the destinations, potentially?
Thank you. I think as we heard yesterday in a lot of the discussions, you know, it keeps coming back to talent. And the last 24 months have changed such a lot for so many businesses. You know, there is no doubt that we have a competitive advantage from having better talent. But the biggest constraint is finding it, hanging on to it by developing it. And I think that's been exacerbated because the power has shifted from the organisation to the person. And the rules of the game have changed. People want and are receiving higher compensation. They want more flexibility. They want a greater sense of community. They want more company purpose. They want an all-inclusive culture. We've all heard of the war for talent. Well, the war for talent is now truly global. And so if I could, can I ask the first question to you, John, which is, sure. And you've sort of touched on it in your introduction, but with this increased competition for talent and the great resignation, as it's being called, what are some key strategies that your company is employing to attract great talent and then retain it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think, and I was reminded on the, went on the health tech tour in Scotland, and the great collaboration, which is a key ingredient really to bring together all the partners necessary to develop a solution that works to address talent challenges, that came out in that very loud and clear with the Helix model of integrating, you know, government and academia and industry and collaborating around workforce development strategies and innovation, and that's what drove innovation. And I think, you know, when we look at how we approach some of the challenges, it's about extending our talent acquisition and training capabilities to partners such as the workforce system, such as education, government, looking at incentives and public-private partnerships. And we have a lot of models for how we're now, as a result of not having available talent, and we can't just go buy that on the market, we have to go build that, make investments, and building that purposefully. So we come together and, you know, around our key needs and regions. We have a regional talent development ecosystem of partners and programs that help prepare both on the future workforce side as well as upskilling our existing employees around critical talent segments and areas. One example of that is in Ocala, Florida, where we partnered with the workforce system. We got support from the governor, the governor's office and elected officials. We got support from the education system, workforce board, partnered with the College of Central Florida, developed a lab environment. So we donated in-kind resources in the way of tools, equipment, supply, instructors. It's a sharing of resources between our internal capabilities and the college's capabilities. At that time, we were hiring 800 electronic assemblers and had a large pipeline need over 4 years to support the missiles and fire control operation there. And we equipped a lab that basically simulated very closely what the work environment was going to be for those individuals that were coming on board. Our instructors were going over there and doing train the trainer with their staff, faculty. And we developed a program that was a six-week articulated program. In addition to that, we've expanded our tuition reimbursement program. We've offered vocational scholarships. We offer a number of strategies to try to widen the aperture of talent, realizing that it's just not available and we have to make those initiatives to build that talent. And so it's been a highly successful program. We've seen an increase in retention as a result of this apprenticeship model that we put in place. We're offering credit courses toward an associate degree for those going in.
Yeah.
And it's really, I could talk a lot more about that, but I'll pause there. And that's just a couple of the strategies that we're employing around.
And I think retention is probably a key factor, isn't it?
It is.
Because, you know, the scarcer top talent becomes, the more companies that aren't on their game are going to have their key people cherry-picked by their competitors.
Right.
And if they're cherry-picked by their competitors, then their competitors are going to get to know their strategies, their operations, etc., which is never good. Maybe in the future this might be more likely with millennials, and I want to bring Corinne in for this, if I may, because, you know, it's a generalization, but maybe millennials are less loyal to their employees than their parents were?
Millennials are. They don't care, right? So I call these the much maligned millennials because most executives, governments, teams, they're irritated and confused by them because they lack complete awareness about most things. But the reality is, if your policies and programs don't support what's important to them, your companies probably won't be here in the future because they will be 50% of the workforce within the next 5 years. When we talk about millennials, they're people that were born from 1981 to 1996. In my home, I have one millennial, one Gen Z, so it's an interesting ecosystem. But you have to give up all hope that they're going to change or go away. They're going to control the U.S. voting bloc until 2050. They're the largest group, larger than the baby boomers, that we've ever seen. And so you're going to have to look for ways to embrace them, encourage them, and grow them, because you're going to end up growing your own top talent. But it's really not super hard, because there's just a few things that they care about. They care about meaning and connection in their jobs and in their life. And 77% of millennials say they would rather have a job and a career that's meaningful that doesn't necessarily pay a lot, which is really good for us because we don't have to overpay people. We don't have to get in a bidding war. They also said that they don't want to be in a job that's highly paid but has no meaning for them or they don't have a passion for. So they care about meaning, connection. You got to find ways to connect with them. So you got to know their names. You got to know their family. You got to make an effort to actually care about these people. They care about flexibility. They do not want the demands of their job to impact their personal life. And a lot of people are seeing that. They're like, what, you can't go? It's like, we have work to do. It's like, yeah, I got to take my dog for a walk, right? You got to pay attention to that because they actually are working all the time. Work is where they are. It's not a place that they go to. And they're very connected. 86% of them check their messages and email at home. So they're working all the time. But flexibility is important to them. They will not let their job impact the quality of life that they want. And they want to be challenged. And I love this about the millennials. I actually love millennials because I can give them really hard projects and they're not afraid to fail. They're not afraid to, they just bounce right back. And you can beat them because they come right back every time. They're like, okay, they're totally teachable. But you have to be, we have to be better managers. We have to be able to be very specific and direct with them. The thing that's frustrating is that I gave a millennial a really big promotion. And I was like, see, I'm doing a good job. I'm taking care of my millennials. And he's like, when am I gonna get my next promotion? And I was like, seriously? Because my generation would be like, thank you so much, you know, I'm so grateful. But like, when am I getting my next promotion? It's not because they're not grateful. It's because they want a challenge. So they want to be prepared for what's next. And so you have to embrace that. Because the companies that make it very easy for millennials to thrive will be the companies that will continue to thrive. And you'll attract more millennials. So it's really not hard, but you have to make sure that your policies, your programs, and your teams support this kind of an environment.
Yeah, and I suppose that leads us on to location very nicely because, you know, if you're trying to attract people, millennials, let's say, well, anybody to a location, then, you know, that suddenly becomes perhaps the front and center issue about where you're going to locate your head office or your hub because it might be really easier, it might be really difficult to retain key people. Patsy, can I come to you about this? The competition for talent, perhaps even prior to COVID, how has that influenced companies' decision-making in terms of their location and really the way you advise them?
Yeah, very good question. So already well before COVID, we saw that a lot of companies were moving away from the pure focus on cost, reducing costs in low-cost locations, putting a lot more emphasis on talent because of the challenges they already saw in finding people. So that is really typically at the core of our investigations, finding the right place where you have a suitable labor force with skills that are very different today than they were 5 years ago, than they were 10 years ago. So where is a suitable labor market? Where is it scalable? Is there sufficient inflow to continue growing? Also scalable to move up and down? Is it flexible from a regulatory perspective? Is it sustainable in the sense of competition? And we heard that a lot. If I establish here, can I continue operating here in an environment where attrition is manageable, where I can keep my people? And also, I think in the last couple of years, more emphasis also on cultural fit. Is this an environment where my corporate culture will fit with the culture locally? And I would say also a lot of focus, and that's what connects with Emma's discussion, and on diversity and inclusion, which is, of course, a big topic for IBM itself. But a lot of our clients are also focusing on that. Quite recently, of course, a lot of emphasis on risk because of all the change and all the disruption that has been caused. How can we try to predict the next risk factor that's going to be around the corner and looking forward and try to anticipate that? So all of that has made the corporate location context quite complex, actually, trying to look forward and see what else is going to be changing, what will have an impact on how I, as an organization, operate and where I'd invest to establish my operations.
I mean, and this is a question really to all of you. Do you think that investment attraction should be more about the quality of life for the employees than perhaps the tax incentives and infrastructure available to the employer? Or do you not think we're quite there yet?
I think it should be both. I mean, I think you still have to have business climate optimization and you know, the quality of life is certainly a big component. Attracting talent is really a big component, and making sure that you have a sustainable operation, and not just because you have incentives, which you can get the work and get investment there, but having the talent to really make sure that you're there 10 years after you land it.
Yeah.
In Utah, we've attracted quite a few people, especially since COVID. So we're the fastest growing state in the nation. We have under 2% unemployment. Bam, Charles. Which means we have a holy war for talent. But what's attracted people to our state is the outdoor recreation is so compelling for people, and they want to have a really great life for their children. We offer tax incentives for companies to co-locate a headquarters or to move an operation there because we're trying to get really high-paying jobs. But our incentives are nothing really compared to other states because we don't have to. Because it's such a great place to live.
Yeah. And I just want to move on to, do you think it's better when you decide to relocate or open a new hub somewhere, do you think it's better to send out existing management teams and existing people or hire locally? What do you think? What do you advise your...
Well, it really depends a bit on the corporate culture, I think, and some of our clients do either way, but I think you have to have a good mix. You want to infuse your corporate culture in a new location, but at the same time, you want to get it right, and you want to know what are the local career aspirations, what is driving these people, what is getting them out of bed every day, what is keeping them up at night, and that's where you really need the local insight. So I think the right mix of both is definitely key there.
Yeah. I was talking to John about this morning, and I was saying, that we had a Spanish company who opened an office in Denmark, and they sent some top leadership team from Spain to run the Denmark office. And the Spanish hierarchy is quite sort of, it's very rigid in a lot of businesses, whereas in Denmark it's a very flat structure. So the Spanish CEO goes in and he says... right, I'd like you to do this, you to do this, you to do this, and then I'd like you to tell your team to do this, and that's what I want you to do. And the Danish team went, well, no, we don't think that's right. We think you should do this. And he thought it was open rebellion. But actually, it was just them having a great conversation with him. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
But they were Vikings, right? So, you're going to pretend to go in there? I think a lot of U.S. companies make a mistake of dropping their top people into a region and be like, you were great in Arkansas, go and make Lisbon fabulous. It's not going to work. So I work in the startup world, and I have a lot of